I think artists, we describe them as being the canaries in the coal mine, which I think is a really good way to say that they're at the forefront of the censorship and culture debates.
Yeah. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Art Persists podcast, a series by Bosler Arts offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. My name's Georgia, and in this episode we speak to Gareth Harris. Gareth is Chief Contributing Editor of The Art newspaper and was previously Deputy Editor there. He has written numerous articles for the Financial Times on the visual arts and art market, and has also written for the New York Times, The Times, Apollo Magazine and Frieze. Gareth is also the author of Censored Art Today, an accessible, informed analysis of the debates raging around censorship of art and the so-called cancel culture, focusing on who the censors are and why they are clamping down on forms of artistic expression worldwide. The book was published 2 years ago, and I really wanted to catch up with Gareth about it and explore these themes in light of an increasingly censored art world today. Let's get right into it. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Hi, Gareth. Thank you so much for coming on the Art Persists podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. How are you? How are you feeling today?
I'm okay, thank you. I've had enough coffee, so I feel equipped to talk about censorship generally. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, it's such a pleasure. And we wanted to have you on today to talk about your book, Censored Art Today, which came out 2 years ago. But we thought it's probably an appropriate time to look back on it and reflect on it, given everything that's going on in the world right now. And so I wanted to start by asking you, how 2 years on, how do you see the book? How do you reflect on it?
That's a really interesting question, because in some ways things have changed a lot, and in some ways they haven't changed very much at all on the art front. And I think, I wrote in my introduction to the book 2 years ago that artists, museums and historic statues are, to use the contemporary term, being cancelled in an ongoing critical debate about their status and value. Mm. The perfect storm of a pandemic, the advancement of anti-intellectual populist governments worldwide, and uprisings against discrimination and inequality, such as Black Lives Matter, have brought about a reset of perspectives and principles. So that was 2 years ago. Mm. But the whole geopolitical landscape itself has moved on now.
Yeah.
And just recently for the March issue of the Art newspaper, I wrote a kind of extensive update with another writer and really prominent activist called Emma Shapiro. Mm. And we wrote the front page piece for the Art newspaper. And the first paragraph said, "Censorship is on the rise globally, say artists and art professionals, two groups that carry the unofficial but historic burden of speaking truth to power, on offering political critique on behalf of wider society." And it's interesting that even 2 years on, I think artists, we describe them as being the canaries in the coal mine, which I think is a really good way to say that they're at the forefront of the censorship and culture debates.
Yeah.
When we spoke to them for the March issue of the Art newspaper, they raised concerns about upholding free speech and artistic freedom in a year when democracy will be tested with elections in more than 70 countries.
Yeah.
Including the US, the UK, India. And we also point out that in today's world, this is all taking place against the backdrop of geopolitical struggles. And we know what they are: Israel-Hamas conflict, Russia's two-year-long invasion of Ukraine, nuclear power rivalry between, say, the US, North Korea and China. So I think it's, in some ways, the argument's developed in a more frightening way, I guess, because I suppose people, artists, curators, feel more suppressed and oppressed than ever. And that can take place in what we call autocracies, such as Russia, where the situation is very frightening.
Yeah.
And it can also take place in bona fide democracies like the UK, actually. Mm. There was a fuss 2 or 3 months ago over Arts Council England.
Yes.
Who found themselves embroiled in this row about restricting funding for political or reputationally damaging, in quotes, work. So it springs up in all sorts of forms and shapes, as you're well aware. So to me, the world is more frightening place, and censorship is even more pervasive, I'm afraid.
Yes, I
agree with you, actually. And I think, yeah, as I was rereading the book just before this interview, I was thinking about how it all, I guess it's all been happening, but at the moment, it just feels like everything is at the forefront. And this, and that's what I also love about your book, is that it, everything kind of feeds into one another. So what we're seeing recently is that something, you know, an artist might post on social media can then get them excluded from a show, or a show has been cancelled, or just all these like very different interlayered things that causes then in turn people to self-censor themselves. And it's just a very complicated, complicated time.
Mm.
And I think the situation in Gaza with Israel, is, I think it's kind of pushed a lot of this to the forefront.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think as Cook, well, Coco Fusco, she's a very prominent Cuban-American artist and activist.
Mm.
She told me for my piece recently in the art newspaper that there are different ways to censor as such. And I think we need to keep that in mind for now. You know, there are bigger issues at play also than the fallout of Western cancel culture and other political pressures. So she said to me, it's crucial to note that censorship is not a monolith. It's practiced in different ways depending on context and law. And she said this, journalists in Gaza are being killed as part of their being censored.
Mm.
People in Russia, Iran, Cuba, China, Nicaragua, El Salvador and elsewhere can be arrested, tortured and imprisoned for long periods after they are censored. That's the harsh reality in those sorts of countries.
Mm.
And then she said to me, and I think this is so cleverly expressed, that would not happen to me in the US. I might not get published, or I might have a show cancelled, or I might even be threatened by powerful art collectors. I'm pressured to remove my signature from a letter calling for a ceasefire.
Mm.
But no one's going to pull my fingernails out or send me to jail.
Yeah.
So I think we always have to keep that in mind. Mm. I think you're right. Against the backdrop of the Israel-Gaza conflict, things have become more heightened and fraught. And I think you spoke to Tania Bruguera a while ago. When? That was a few months ago.
A few months ago. So she was, we released her episode as part of the last season just before Christmas, actually. And she's fantastic.
She is. And she was recently on the Art Newspapers podcast, which is called The Week in Art. And she was saying some really pertinent things. And it's hard to get your head around some of these sentiments.
Mm.
She said, I think it's worse in the West than in China, basically, because people are living in a fantasy land and they don't want to see it. They justify censorship. They use the same mechanism, blaming the person, instead of looking at the system that generated the censorship.
Mm.
And it was interesting. I don't know if you saw, she was doing a nonstop reading in Berlin recently, the Hamburger Bahnhof. And that event was shut down after a group of visitors stormed the talk, chanting, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," which I know is a controversial slogan.
Yeah, it is.
Especially in Germany.
Yes.
So I think she's at the coal face, so to speak, canary in the coal mine or whatever. And she's really been up against it, I suppose. But it's opened up so many difficult debates.
Mm.
I mean, the German debate is very tense, intense as well.
Very intense.
And I don't know how you feel that, or if you've been tracking it, but how it's playing out there is very difficult to monitor lately. And I've been following the situation with the artist Candice Brights.
Mm.
She had a show cancelled at the Saarland Museum in East Germany last year. The controversy began over a comment she made about the conflict in Gaza.
Yeah.
She's Jewish. She's a Jewish artist.
Yeah.
And at the end of October, Brights wrote on social media it was possible to support the Palestinian struggle for basic rights and human dignity, while unequivocally condemning the horrific carnage exacted on the 7th of October.
Mm.
In November, the Saarland Museum cancelled Brights' exhibition, saying it would not show the art of any artist, I'll put this in quotes, who does not clearly recognise Hamas's terror as a rupture of civilization.
Mm.
The director of that museum has since stepped down.
Wow.
The controversy has escalated.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to monitor what's going on there at the moment.
I know.
But I don't know if you think, you know, Germany's particularly tense, I suppose.
I think so. I think, I mean, obviously the UK is also going through it, and also America, and then the rest of the world as well. I think it's just something that's kind of pushed to the surface so many different issues, not only in the arts, obviously, but for politics as well, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. I mean, I've been hearing some really crazy stories of friends who have been, you know, what they're getting face value of in Germany and also here. So I think it's just a really, really crazy time. And how do you find it? Obviously, you're chief contributing editor at the art newspaper. Do you ever face these kind of conflicts within your work? Do you ever put something out and then find that people are writing to you, you know, going against it, or do you not have that kind of pressure?
It's funny, we do get a reaction to some censorship stories. Mm. I was in Hong Kong two weeks ago for Art Basel Hong Kong, and that felt particularly fraught as well because the situation there is very difficult for artists. Mm. And we were reporting on the art fair there, but it's been tense in Hong Kong since 2020 when they introduced a national security law, which means many artists have fled the country, actually.
Yeah.
And just before we arrived in Hong Kong, a new security law was passed called Article 23,
which
you might be aware of with your different projects. And that's made things much more difficult as well for artists in Hong Kong. We did a piece in the art newspaper by our reporter Lisa Movias, and she reported the backers and opponents alike say Article 23 simply reinforces extended policies that have clamped down on resistance against Hong Kong's Beijing-controlled government. But certain things do really set readers off. I mean, last year we ran a story about Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist and activist. Mm. This was quite a difficult thing to report, I suppose, because you could say it was a real-world consequence of today's cancel culture as such.
What was the piece about?
Ai Weiwei was due to have an exhibition at Listen Gallery in London.
Yeah.
That was cancelled because he sort of put out a tweet relating to the Israel-Hamas war.
Yeah.
Part of his tweet said, "The sense of guilt around the persecution of the Jewish people has been at times transferred to offset the Arab world." It was translated in different ways at the time.
Mm.
So that was a point of debate as well about how you communicate those points.
Yeah.
But then when I spoke to him recently for the piece we did in the art newspaper, he told me the experience of growing up in an authoritarian society tells me about the importance of being an individual and the necessity of defending our essential rights. I should say as well, also, Listen Gallery explained that they, you know, they felt it was okay, it was important to cancel the exhibition. So they did put out a statement defending their position.
Yes.
We have to say that as well. that's important.
Mm.
But that's had real consequences, I think, for him as an artist. I'm sure, you know, people noticed that the exhibition had been pulled.
Mm.
So that ripple effect is ongoing, I suppose.
Yes. So we're going to talk more about the book, obviously, but I wondered if we could take it back a bit and talk about you and your life. Tell us a bit about your early life, where you grew up and what life was like.
I'm Welsh, you can probably tell. Have that lilt.
Lovely.
I was born in Cardiff. My family lives just outside Cardiff in a town called Pontypridd. Came to university in London to study languages, Royal Holloway, which is part of London University.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, did a master's at UCL. Went back to Royal Holloway and did a PhD.
Oh, wow.
Which took forever.
What was your PhD in?
It's Italian Futurist Art.
Oh, nice.
And by Umberto Boccioni. So I compare his works with those of the Swiss poet Blaise Sandra. So it's a poetry painting thing.
Wow.
Took me forever. And I was a teacher first of languages, French and Spanish and Italian. Then I moved into art publishing. And then I went to the Victoria and Albert Museum, where I was a press officer for almost 4 years.
Mm.
And I left there 2003. And I managed to secure a staff writing job at the art newspaper, where I've been ever since.
Yeah.
And, I was deputy editor for a short while, 2005 to 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I work mainly on a monthly contract, writing for the website every day. We have a daily newsletter.
Yeah.
And that's why the censorship book was so, just seemed like a natural progression, because I've been covering censorship stories there for a long time.
Yeah.
And Lunt Humphreys, the publisher, along with Sotheby's Institute, started this series called Hot Topics. And I went along and suggested the censorship idea because it just seems so important. The only thing is that, as I would say, as I keep saying, it was published in 2022. Now I just want to keep updating things. But I'm really lucky in that with the Art newspaper, I can do that from as a news platform, which is great. And there was an initial plan to start a blog called Trigger Warning, which would look at censorship issues every month. And we did start that. We started this last year on the back of a story about Michelangelo's David in Florence.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. It got... What happened with that?
That's a good question, actually, because I think it was 2022 the story first broke. It was a Florida school, I think. And this just kind of shows how heightened the debate gets about censorship. There was a principal called Hope Carrasquilla working at I think it was called Tallahassee Classical School. But basically, a school principal in Tallahassee, Florida, was fired following parental complaints about a lesson on Michelangelo's marble masterpiece, David, which was deemed pornographic by one of the parents. One of the parents felt point blank upset. Carrasquilla, this is the principal, told the Huffington Post, and felt her child should not be viewing the iconic 16th century Renaissance sculpture. I'm not sure what happened at the end, actually. The last I heard, well, she was obviously fired. But what was really important about this whole episode was the fact it was on the back of a kind of wave of conservative education legislation in Florida under the governor, Ron DeSantis, who was recently running against Trump. I think he pulled out of the race. And he had quite a radical agenda. He targeted high school advanced placement studies in African American history as a form of woke indoctrination, signed a bill to ban transgender athletes from girls' public school teams. He banned more than 40% of maths textbooks that publishers submitted for review and passed something called the Parental Rights in Education Act, which prohibited any conversation about sexuality and gender in kindergarten and the first three gay grades of elementary school. This was all denounced by critics as don't say gay. So this is, that was that rising tide of kind of censorship in that sense, I guess, from a legislative point of view, which was very difficult to process, actually. I think the whole David thing, which sounds silly at times, it exemplified the kind of general hysteria sometimes of getting caught up in the culture war.
It's so true. And I think also if you look at like now the way that book bannings in schools in America has just accelerated. And often it's the case, the same for what you just described, of maybe one or two parents being upset with a book that's often on themes of gender, sexuality, LGBTQ topics that are then taken out of school libraries instantly.
Well, there's an amazing statistic in that recent report I ran in the Art newspaper. In the US, activist groups such as PEN America, they continue to track what they call educational gag orders. So these are defined as the spread of prohibitions to restrict teaching about topics such as race, gender, LGBTQ identities. And PEN America's research revealed that of the 3,362 instances of books banned in the 2022-23 school year, certain themes, formats, and identities recur. And this statistic, to me, really stands out. 30% of those banned books included characters of colour, or they were discussing race and racism. And 30% of those books included LGBTQ themes and characters. I mean, that, to me, seems a bit irrational. But that's the way, I suppose, in the run-up to the election in America, these things are playing out. I mean, I find that pretty terrifying.
It is terrifying. It really is.
PEN America does a great job at tracking that kind of thing.
They do.
But the whole David scenario, going back to that, I think that raised so many questions. How should children be taught about race, racism, gender? To what extent can the Republican Party regulate and possibly politicize education?
Yes.
And can children's education be transformed into a political weapon? Mm. Should it be a flashpoint for a wider culture war as such?
Yeah.
And then where's all this heading? What happens if Trump is elected?
Oh, God.
Hi, this is Hossam Fazula, co-founder of Bosla Arts. The Artists podcast is independently run by Bosla Arts, me and Georgia, which allows us to share these important conversations with artists and activists from all over the world. In order to keep having these conversations, we need your help. Join us on Patreon for as little as £3 and help us continue this vital work. More info in the episode description. Now back to the podcast.
So the first chapter of your book picks three different regions, looking at Hong Kong, Cuba, and the Middle East, I think, particularly a few Gulf states, and how different kind of regimes are working to censor and crack down on artists. What I found really interesting is that also, so you start in this first chapter, which is talking about these three places, and obviously you mentioned Hong Kong, and you start with this really visually devastating scene of this Pillar of Shame, this big statue in the University of Hong Kong, being torn down. I think it was in
2021,
exactly. And this statue was representing the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989 in China. And it kind of, by it being pulled down, it signaled this new change between the relationship between Hong Kong and China. And as you said at the beginning of this interview, that's now been kind of solidified even more. And then you end the book with this, with the pulling down of the statue of Edward Colston in Bristol, who was a transatlantic slave trader and was pulled down, obviously two incredibly different contexts. But as I kind of read the book, I was thinking about this question of statues and who they are actually for and who they belong to. And I just wanted to get your opinion. Not necessarily has to be about the two different statues, but, you know, we've also seen the more recently the work of a portrait of Lord Balfour in Cambridge being attacked,
slashed.
How do you feel? I mean, what's your view on statues in general and this kind of this relationship between people and statues?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You mentioned the artist Jens Galschio. He created the statue in Hong Kong, the sculpture. It's called the Pillar of Shame. I think it was erected in 1997 at the University of Hong Kong. Mm. And then it was surreptitiously removed at the end of 2021.
Yeah.
It was just taken down more or less overnight, I think. Workmen were seen taking away the top half in darkness, winching it up on a crane. And I think that is a really potent symbol of censorship in its most blatant form.
Yes.
You're just taking down this memorial to those who were killed in Tiananmen Square, actually. Mm. We have to say that Hong Kong University said the decision to remove the statue, which is kind of a mass of corpses and faces, was based on external legal advice. Mm. And they also cited safety reasons. Mm. But it was a really key moment because it reflected how political dissent in Hong Kong or public facing acts of defiance would no longer be tolerated by the Beijing government.
Yeah.
And Jens Galschio, he's very vocal. I think last month he said there was some sort of exhibition around the Pillar of Shame being presented at the European Parliament. Mm. So he's continuing in that campaign. Yeah. But it was pretty shocking to see that physical destruction of a piece.
Yeah.
And as I said, he's continuing the campaign, and I kind of talk to him regularly about what he thinks might happen now. Mm. But you could say that symbolizes how restrictive society has become in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
But your question was, what do I feel about monuments?
Mm. It's a hard question.
It's a really hard debate. And I think they've become such a flashpoint for the culture war generally.
Mm.
But there's a really great journalist called Tyler Steem. I think I quoted him in the book. Mm. And he was quoted in The Guardian, I think. And he says, as the lens through which people view the world comes to feel insufficient, they go looking for deeper explanations and discover the buried continuities between the injustices of the past and the present. Mm. but many of other people have arrived at the opposite conclusion. The situation is bad today because we have strayed too far from the way things used to be. The nostalgia of Brexit and Make America Great Again is exactly an appeal to the consoling idea for some white people that the moral failures of the past are in fact the triumphs we once thought they were. Mm. Statues, buildings and street signs have become flashpoints because they embody the tension between these two worldviews. It's hard because the destruction and dismantling of problematic monuments has sort of accelerated since 2020. And the main, one of the most prominent examples is Edward Colston in Bristol, when protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters, ripped it down, threw him in the harbour. And that moment is just, you know, it's kind of imprinted in my brain because I think it was pandemic year, of course. Everything seemed, everyone was caught up in the pandemic, and suddenly we were talking about the place of historic monuments in British towns and cities. I don't know. I mean, I find it very difficult to kind of defend bringing a statue down. I'm not sure if it's the right thing to be doing. Where do we put them? Some people say they should be placed in museums. I think what they did with the Colston was fantastic. They put it in a museum in Bristol. And there were queues around the block waiting to see this graffitied, battered effigy. And I just think, wow, that's just so fantastic that people want to see a symbol of, well, it's not a great symbol, but a symbol of the past in a context they think makes sense. And I think the I think Colston's gone back to that museum in Bristol. I don't know. I mean, do you think that these things should still be standing? I mean, should we try to re-edit, retain history? The government kind of wants us to do that through a policy called Retain and Explain. So the current Tory government, very against dismantling these things, these monuments. They think they should be told or retold in a new context. And I do see some sense in that. But if you're a member of an ethnic minority and there's a slave trader on your corner, I don't think it really, I think it's pretty offensive to see that symbol of history on your doorstep. And I don't know what's the proper way through.
It's so, and I'm sorry I asked you the question because I know how hard of a question it is. And I think it's, I think so much of it is like each individual case, because it's impossible to say one thing for every single monument and sculpture that is in this country or around the world. I think what was interesting when I read your chapter in the book was that you mentioned that for kind of years before, the community had been trying to get this statue taken down, and that there wasn't this kind of, and I think that's maybe what I view most, is that if you're, that the statues are there for the people, and if you, and so it should be part of a conversation, basically, a group decision.
Yeah, I mean, Colston's been a controversial figure in Bristol for years and years. I don't know, it's very hard. I mean, I think the danger is that reframing a subject in a new light, in the manner of Retain and Explain, which means contextualizing the genesis and history, is simply a more edifying take on episodes and figures, normally white men, who just don't deserve to be whitewashed. It's a very difficult subject to contextualize and, you know, articulate. And I'm not sure. I mean, perhaps they should all be in one big museum. Who knows?
Who knows?
I mean, there's going to be there was a proposal, I think, when I wrote the book for Confederate statues in America to be shown in an exhibition at a space called Lax Art in Los Angeles. There's a great curator there called Hamza Walker. He's the director of Lax Art. His plan was to invite contemporary artists to make works in response to these controversial historic statues. I think that's still going ahead with the artist Cara Walker.
Okay.
I need to catch up on that, though. But I think that is a fantastic idea. We can have a contemporary response in some way to these outdated figures. I think that would be a brilliant
be
way
really
forward. But who knows? And I mean, should we keep putting up monuments to historic figures? I don't know.
I don't know either.
They are very potent symbols of a particular moment in time. And are they always moments we want to capture?
I don't know about that. And also, there's just also that thing of a statue when it's like towering over you. I remember, although I cannot remember when exactly this was, but there was in Oxford, there was a statue of Rhodes.
Who, oh, yeah.
Would look at you as you walked into the university. And it's like, why would anyone want to have to look at that every time they walked into a university?
Well, the Rhodes statue is also a controversial one.
Yeah.
And I think Anthony Gormley suggested turning him around. Oh, yeah. So I thought, wow.
Yeah.
Why not? But I know that's another difficult one, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. And I think they have tried to contextualise that, the college, on a plaque. Some people say it's not enough. There's not enough context, new context.
Yes.
Is that where you were in college?
I wasn't actually, but I just remember it when it was really, when the conversation was really in the press.
But it's still standing. That's,
yeah.
I mean, so what's happened? Is there progress?
Exactly. I remember I went to this very big, like, stately home in Austria, in Salzburg, a long time ago for this seminar. And the house had been decorated in this amazing, beautiful way. I mean, it was, you know, maybe 150 years old. But in one room, they had these paintings on the wall, kind of frescoes with blackface. And they were preserving it and trying to recontextualize it and talk about the issues. But at the end of the day, it still felt awful, you know, to be. It didn't work. So anyway.
It's just a visual reminder, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and it's about, yeah. I wanted to kind of end this conversation looking at the dreaded social media question, because social media is such an important platform for art and for artists, especially those who are emerging or putting their work out there. But it's also, you know, it's a few platforms that are global in reach, but are controlled by just a few hands. And I was thinking, just kind of reflecting on your chapter about social media in terms of censorship and shadow banning, what you think about it looking back, and also how you think about it in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me was the most interesting part of the book to research and write, because I came to realise how a vast number of artists rely on social media as a commercial and critical platform. Mm. I mean, artists sell works through Instagram. And then when I started looking into it more and more, I spoke to lots of artists, both here and in the United States. I realized so many of them had, well, a large number had been banned from Instagram. I'm not an expert on TikTok, really. It's a difficult one. I think I said in that chapter that, you know, the most complex and murkier censorship battles are being fought on social media. Mm. And it's still kind of going under the radar of most people, in the sense that, for instance, why is the female nipple still prohibited, for instance?
Yeah.
I think that is still going on, but that was a huge debate about why the female nipple could not be shown, blah, blah. And I go into a lot of detail in the book about how, in a ridiculous way, the first kind of flashpoint for me was banning a 30,000-year-old statue called the Venus of Willendorf.
Yes.
It's quite a voluptuous statue. But that was initially banned by Facebook, now Meta, on the grounds that it was dangerously pornographic, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. Although I have to say Facebook or Meta eventually relented with the Venus of Willendorf, saying it made an exception for the depiction of nudity in this case because the offending item is a statue. I think I was right to sort of conclude that over the past decade, some institutions and artists have found themselves at the sharp end of these corporations, the social media giants, which appear still unable to differentiate between art and pornography.
Yeah.
And the basic crux is that both Instagram and its parent company, Meta, both ban photographic representations of the naked body. Mm. So that's what artists found difficult, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, they have evolved, actually, those social media giants. Mm. And they come up with different community guidelines every so often with different kind of restrictions and rules.
Yeah.
But the algorithms are still at play. Instagram's community guidelines still bewilder artists. The social media site disallows nudity, but photos in the context of breastfeeding and that kind of thing are still issues relating to breast cancer awareness. Mm. They are allowed, those sorts of images.
Yeah.
Nudity is also allowed in photos of paintings and sculptures. But as I wrote in the book, and I will check this, crucially, the social media platform's nudity ban does not extend to male nipples.
Yeah.
So female, problematic. Yeah. Male, okay. Which seems absurd, I suppose. Yeah. And I'm not really understood why that ruling was kind of made. And then again, shadow banning was a huge deal for a lot of the artists I spoke to, which is complex sometimes to explain. But basically, a shadow ban hides your post from users who do not follow you, so that all the hashtag used to expand an individual's reach are in essence redundant.
Yeah.
So it's all about the how. You might know more than me.
No.
Shadow banning. Social media writer Shantae Joseph wrote that the result is that images are not outright removed, but instead strategically hidden from users.
Yeah.
So it's all around the hashtag and certain hashtags. And users who say they're unaware of the ban say they, you know, alarm bells ring when they experience sudden drops in engagement or reach.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's still going on. Mm. So this really affects how some artists show their works and
absolutely.
And the platform and, you know, the kind of reach for their work and that kind of thing. And it's still a problem. So there's still a lot to be said about censorship on social media.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to research. You can't always get answers. If you're banned, the artists get very frustrated because they can't always get a response or they've given a certain number of strikes and they're out. Mm. So social media censorship is an area that still needs a lot of investigation.
Yes. It would be interesting to look one day at this. Also, the way that artists have changed their works based on what social media likes, because I see that sometimes, like, obviously, like, Instagram in general, it likes faces and, you know, close-up faces, eye contact. So it would be interesting to see if that also impacts the way that artists are able to, like, shape their practice as well.
Well, I think that's really interesting. Some of the artists I spoke to started to adapt their practice to get on Instagram and other social media platforms. I mean, possibly that's self-censorship, I suppose.
Yeah.
Depends how you want to describe that. But a few artists try to, I suppose you could also argue they were trying to circumnavigate the ban by doing that. But then are they really staying true to their practice?
Yeah.
It's a difficult one. But yeah, I mean, it's an argument that still needs to be analysed in depth, to be honest. Absolutely. And those other platforms, I mean, TikTok, I'm not sure. I'm sure they have community guidelines.
Oh, yeah. I think I don't know that much about TikTok myself, but I think it's a whole nother area.
Yeah, and Twitter. I mean, I've not really gone into the whole Twitter.
I mean, it's field. And that's the thing that's hard. It's like, who are the decision makers and what are they basing it on and what do they believe? I mean, I guess in the same way as the David situation we were just talking about, it's these kind of weird decisions being made in the hands of a very, very few people.
Yeah, that's right. And as I said, some artists really rely on it for commercial income, which is what's always very worrying for them.
Yeah. Gareth, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I look forward to maybe a part two of Sense and Art today.
That would be really good, actually. Part two, an update.
Great.
Because these things just develop all the time. But thank you very much for inviting me. And it's great to discuss some of those current issues around censorship.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Many thanks to Gareth for joining us for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about his work or read the book, you can find links in the episode description. And thank you for joining us for another episode of the Art Assist podcast. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, all we ask is that you follow us, share the podcast with friends and family, and maybe even give us a rating wherever you listen. Only with your help can these really important stories be heard. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode.